Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I teach philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Maisha Cherry. Maisha is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California at Riverside. She specializes in moral psychology, social and political philosophy, philosophy of race, and feminist philosophy. Maisha also hosts the popular Unmute podcast. Her new book has recently been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled The Case for Rage: Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. Now, according to a broad consensus among philosophers across the ages, anger is almost always regrettable, counterproductive, and bad. It's something that we need to overcome or suppress. It's treated as something that involves an immoral drive for revenge or some naive commitment to cosmic justice. It's often said to involve a corruption of the person. Anger eats away at us or plunges us into madness. However, given the state of the world, it's difficult not to be angry. Thus, the shelves of your local bookstore are filled with self-help titles that promise to release you from anger and bring you peace. But maybe anger has been underappreciated. Perhaps we failed to make the right distinctions between different kinds of anger. And maybe we've therefore overlooked the kind or the kinds of anger that are productive and appropriate. In The Case for Rage, Maisha Cherry argues that we need to give anger a chance. After distinguishing different forms of anger, she defends a kind of anger that she calls Lordian rage, which she argues is central to anti-racist social progress. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, but we'll begin, as we normally do, with our guest. Hi, Maisha.
How you doing, Bob?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm good. Just woke up from a nap, so I'm like full of energy, but also fatigued, if that makes sense. You can come up with a word with a combination of both.
I'm really excited to be talking with you today about your book.
Oh, likewise.
But before we get into it, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, you've already mentioned kind of like the academic tidbits. I guess I'll say a little bit about myself that people may not know, only those that are close to me. So I love all things Wes Anderson, all things Francois Truffaut, all things Ozu. So I became a cinephile during the pandemic. So I like to, that was a flex in some way, but also a description. Right. Also, I'm a huge record collector, and jazz is really the most treasured aspect of my record collection. So I'm currently collecting all the original Donald Byrd albums. So if anyone is listening, mm-hmm. and they're thinking about getting rid of their record collection, and they have some original Donna Byrd collections, you know, send me an email. Let's talk. Let's chat. I would really love to have them in my collection.
That's fabulous. Can you say something about how you got into some of the philosophical topics that animate you? given all your interest in art?
Yeah. So you would think that because of that, I would be interested in aesthetics. And one of the things I promised myself is that I'm not going to mix business with pleasure. I'm gonna do my little hobbies, and I don't want to feel like when I do my hobbies, I'm also doing work. So it's interesting because some of my early publishing stuff was in the Open Court Public Philosophy series, and a lot of this stuff required us to kind of watch film. So there's a few collections that I was in, such as like The Wire, and such as Orange is the New Black. And I remember in preparation for those essays, I would have to rewatch. I was already fans of the series, but I had to rewatch it, not as a fan, but as a scholar. And it dawned on me, I don't really like this too much. Like, I like to experience the pleasure of art and not really the business of art. So that's one of the reasons why I don't do aesthetics. It's like, I want to enjoy these pleasures without having to think about them from an intellectual perspective. But I guess in connection, I mean, my interest in emotions don't really fall far from the aesthetic tree, right? You know, because Jesse Prince, his love for aesthetics is also rooted, at least one of his aspects of love for this sex is rooted in the emotions. And so in some ways I can cheat by intellectually focusing on the emotions in public life, but just not in aesthetic life.
I see. You know, I have a similar story about cinema, particularly. My wife has for a long time, for most of her life actually, has been obsessed with films. And you know, when I met her, I thought films were movies.
Oh no.
And so, you know, for the, 30 years or whatever we've known each other, she's kept a long list of the films that she can't believe that I'd never seen before I met her.
She's one of those people.
She's like, "You've never seen Casablanca?" I'm like, "No." She's like, "What's wrong with you?" I'm like, "Sorry." But thanks to her, I've developed an interest in film that I would call a philosophical but non-professional interest, if that makes sense. So I have no aspirations to be a philosopher of film, but I've found ways to appreciate film in philosophical ways, if that makes sense.
Well, cool.
Why don't we talk about the book? How's that?
Let's do it.
So I'm going to begin at the beginning. Okay. Now, you mention this in the book and you puzzle with it. It's rare to find so many philosophers of such different traditions and historical epochs agreeing about anything. But it seems that there's a surprising, almost consensus to a person that anger is bad. Right. You know, can you tell us a little bit about that?
So here's the thing. I'm sympathetic to that assessment, right? And so I think it's a broad stroke view, right? So there's no doubt that I think that some manifestations, I mean, particularly if you come from an environment where you've seen people act out in rage, whether that's your parents, then you can easily come to that conclusion, and you'll be tempted to paint all anger as such, right? If you come from a politically contentious state and where people are just constantly angry, and the citizens are constantly angry against one another, and all this multiple division, it's easy to come to that conclusion. But I think the mistake that is being made, and the mistake that I think that has been made, that just because an instance of anger could be destructive, could be dangerous, could be worrisome, it doesn't necessarily mean that all manifestations or all instances of the emotion is indeed problematic. And I think one of the things that I like to do is do a comparison, is that we have a tendency to look at love and its varieties. So we can admit that, hey, you know, there's different versions of love connected to its object and connected to its intensity. So erotic, you got philia, you got agape. And we're able to make the distinctions between those two. You got requited and you got unrequited, right? You got unconditional and you got conditional, right? We can make these distinctions, these very careful distinctions when it comes to love, and then assess it accordingly. And I think, I don't know what it is. I think we fail to do the same thing with anger. And I think I'm trying to challenge people in the book to look at anger's varieties. And when we're able to do that, then we can see a variety, recognize a variety through the distinctions that I suggest that we should make and say, you know what? Yeah, this instance is indeed problematic. But this instance is not, or this type is not because of these particular reasons. So in some ways, I think I see a project in the book is kind of to build up our emotional intelligence, I think more specifically, to build up our angry emotional intelligence so we can stop painting anger in broad strokes, so we can start really disagreeing with each other in the ways that I kind of lay out. I think the view is just too simplistic. It's an overgeneralization. And I think the conversations can be much more interesting when we see anger in its varieties and we're able to make proper distinctions based on the kind of guidelines that I provide in the book.
Right. And so is the, just to pick up on the analogy with love, where, as you had mentioned, you know, we distinguish different kinds of love by thinking about different objects or the different aims, and the rest. And so I take it that, or having read the book, I'm inviting you to say just a little bit more about how those kinds of distinctions between object and aim and intensity, and maybe some of the motivational aspects, help you to delineate the differences between different anger types.
Yeah. So one of the things that I do in the book is I kind of start off saying, hey, I think there's a variety of angers that can be experienced in the context of political injustice. And I'm just going to offer up a few and get us kind of thinking about what makes these different types different from the other. And so one distinction that I make is that we can evaluate anger according to what it's directed at. So is it, and I'm very much concerned with the context of racial justice, is it directed at racist attitudes, racist policies, or is it simply directed at scapegoats?
Right.
Is it directed at a systemic problem, or is it just simply directed at a person who targeted you and you're not really concerned about how this manifests in other contexts and other people who are much more vulnerable, right? So it's no doubt that it's the targets that's going to help us make these distinctions. You mentioned aim. So what is the aim that someone has? What is it directed at? So is it directed at hatred and elimination of the other? Right. Or, is it directed at a transformation of our world so that we can live in a greater society in which there's equality and there's justice? Is one just concerned about justice just for themselves? Right. So you got your aims. But also another way that we can distinguish it is by the perspective that kind of influences it. And this is kind of like a cognitive kind of feature here. It's like, what is a person thinking about when they have this particular anger? Like, what is a general, one might say kind of mini worldview that's really not only framing the way in which one looks at the problem or the problem, but what is, and I think that's a very important piece because that's going to help us also try to figure out what is the anger. So the anger that I defend in the book is Lonely Rage, and the kind of perspective that I say that influences that anger is kind of an inclusive perspective, right? This kind of notion that, hey, I'm not free until everyone gets free. And that's going to have a tremendous effect on not only who is directed at, but the kind of actions that we undertake in order to bring about a kind of transformation. But for other people, the perspective could be very exclusive. Right. So that's how I kind of get us to kind of think quite differently. What is it aimed at? What is the target? What is the perspective that influences it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those kinds of things. I think it's five features. It's those kind of things that's going to help us make these important distinctions. So I kind of start off with the book trying to be clever in a sense with the titles that I give to these anger types. And so I kind of talk about kind of a white rage. And when I think about what happened at the Capitol, when I think about the storming of the Capitol, let me be a little bit more specific here, the storming of the Capitol, the insurrection that took place at the Capitol on January 6th. But I think about what took place in Charlottesville. I mean, that's a good example of what I call white rage, right? The aim is to eliminate the other. The perspective that kind of informs it is, we just want justice for ourselves.
Right.
This zero-sum game kind of way of thinking about what the goods of our society can give. And you can contrast that with what I call kind of a narcissistic rage, which seems, you know, very different from that more destructive kind and quite similar to the kind of virtuous anger that I'm defining in the book, but it's quite not there yet. Then I say, hey, Lordian rage. I mean, it's directed at racism, racist policies. It, you know, aims to transform our world, has an inclusive perspective, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the rage that I defend in the book. But that's not to say that there's not other kind of more, I guess one can say, virtuous kinds. And I just lift one up and defend right. one in the book.
Perfect. Do you see that the different kinds of, you delineate five different varieties of rage, rogue rage and wipe rage and resentment, narcissistic and Lordian. Do they differ in their targets, in that it seems as if what you call Lordian rage, which I want to ask you to talk about in some more detail in a moment, but what you call Lordian rage looks like it's anger that is aimed at policies and systems, whereas the other forms of rage, or at least some of them, look like they're aimed at people. Is that a way to make a distinction?
It could be both, right? So, you know, feminists, you know, are right to say this. I think Alice McLachlan, says this about, you know, there's some moments in which, particularly when you experience racial oppression, sexist oppression, you don't know who is to blame, right? Your anger is directed at the circumstances that you find yourself in, right? That could be brought about by racist policies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, but that's not to say that Lordian rage is only angry at circumstances. I mean, I'm borrowing from Audre Lorde's Uses of Anger essay, and she starts to talk about kind of a variety of things: racist people who are complicit in racism, racist attitudes, racist people. So it's persons and it's circumstances. I mean, that particular essay in which she's trying to give an account of the uses of anger. I mean, her anger is in response to feminist allies, white feminist allies right. in the struggle, right? So it's very much directed at people. But it's not exclusively so, because sometimes we just don't know who it is to blame. So it's people, and it's also circumstances, I think. And this is how I think what makes Lordian rage a little bit more productive than the other kinds, I think, sometimes, is that it's one way to say, hey, I don't know who's responsible, so I'm just mad at the circumstances. I think what can allow those other kinds of rage to go awry is that it's directed at the wrong people. So it's like, hey, it's politicians who's putting these particular policies in place, but they're making you blame it on, or making you think that it's immigrants that you ought to blame. So right. scapegoats, et cetera, et cetera. And I suggest that Lordian rage gives us kind of at least a closer epistemic picture about who the correct target is.
Great. So let's... I found it really helpful in reading the book to think about Lordian rage in contrast with these other varieties. So I want to sort of take a step back and ask you to say a little bit more about each of the other varieties. So rogue, wipe, resentment, and narcissistic rage. Can you run us through just what you see as the main ways in which these other varieties are contrasted with the kind of anger and rage that you want to that you develop, the theory of which you develop and promote, and maybe some of the ways in which the narcissistic rage, as you just said a moment ago, is sort of almost there, but not quite.
Yeah. So there seem to be, you know, I want to be careful with saying one feature is more important than the other. But if we want to talk about kind of trends or kind of like similarities between the other less productive kinds, it goes back to that perspective, that influences that I was referring to. And as well as the aim, right? So you think about, if your aim is to eliminate the other, and the perspective that includes it is kind of like the zero-sum game, right? Mm. Then that's going to have an effect on the actions that you engage in, right, to bring about the end result, right? So we started this conversation talking about, why do people think anger is so destructive and dangerous, and why we should get rid of it? I think those destructive kinds and those particular features kind of answer that question, right? So if I think, that you should be eliminated. And particularly because I believe that we can't share resources because there's not enough resources, then you can imagine that I am going to storm the Capitol, right? I am going to, you know, kind of express words such as you will not replace me kind of language, right?
Right.
And to kind of see, I mean, if any similarity in that sense, you would get the sense that rogue rage, white rage, would have those kinds of features, even resentment rage. So that I think that's kind of like a what they share in common, that kind of similar kind of aiming and perspective. And narcissistic rage, it may seem like narcissistic rage is not like those other kinds, and it's closer to lording rage. So one of the things I say about narcissistic rage is like, hey, the two errors that it makes that make it the case that it's not yet lording rage is that it fails to see. Now you can imagine, let me just give you an example of a narcissistic rage experience. So the example that I kind of use in the book is, you know, there was a video that went viral a few years ago of a white man who was at an airport. And I don't know what happened, but he's being arrested. And all you can do is hear him screaming in a viral video, "You're treating me like a black person. You're treating me like a black person." And, you know, you got to kind of think about this. I mean, Bell Hooks, I mean, I borrow the narcissistic rage terminology from her, and she uses it to describe black elites who are doing well until they get stopped by the police, who have segregated themselves from the, you know, kind of working class communities until they get stopped by the police. They are mad, kind of similar to the guy at the airport. They're mad at the ways in which the police is treating them. So their anger is directed, but not at the systemic issues that perhaps kind of problematic that some police officers engage in. Like, they are completely oblivious to that and really don't care and is indifferent to that systemic problem, right? The target of their anger is, you have targeted me, right? Particularly because I'm supposed to be the exception in some sorts, whether that's because of my class or whether that's because of my race. So you can imagine kind of the perspective that influences it, particularly when it comes to narcissistic rage. For me, it's kind of like this kind of hierarchical kind of view of oneself, that one thinks of oneself as the exception, right? Now, that's not, oh, you don't want to eliminate the other. It's not even a zero-sum game kind of thinking. But as long as you have that particular thinking, that's going to have an impact on the kind of work that you're going to engage in. You're probably not going to engage in a lot of social action to kind of bring about change for everyone, right? Because one is only concerned with oneself. So as soon as that case get settled, right, as soon as that lawsuit gets settled, as soon as that one police officer elicits, you know, apology for the way in which they treated you, the problem has gone away for you while people still suffer, right? So it's almost there, but it's not quite there just yet. And you kind of contrast that with loading rage. Well, loading rage is very attuned to, listen, it's racist officers, racist individuals, but racism, racist policies, it recognizes that there's a systemic issue. It has hit you today, but it's hit somebody yesterday, and it's going to hit somebody the next day. It's attuned to these particular things. And so that's going to have an impact, right, in the actions that one engage in order to bring about a true transformation. And that's why I suggest that that's the kind of anger that we need, because it's going to motivate a particular kind of action. So you can slowly kind of see kind of, you know, one of the things that I say in the book is that, hey, I understand anger critics. But please know that based on these distinctions that I'm making, it's white rage that you should be concerned about. It's resentment rage that you can be concerned about. You probably haven't thought about narcissistic rage. You may even be proud about your narcissistic rage, but trust me, that's not going to get liberation for everybody. And it's not even going to get the kind of liberation that you think that you need for yourself. So let's arrive at the Lordian kind. And then throughout the book, I kind of add some additional kind of argument for why not only does Lordian rage has these particular features, but it's doing a kind of work in the world that I think... that I think can bring about a true change.
Right. Perfect. So let's pick up on that, because, you know, it seems then that one of the ways in which you in the book sort of make the distinction between Lordian rage and the other forms, particularly narcissistic rage, is by talking about the way that emotions can represent the world, right? Or involve a representation of the world. So as you were just explaining, it looked as if narcissistic rage doesn't represent the world in the way that Lordian rage does, right? Because the Lordian rage is motivated or involves, or part of the syndrome is a representation of the world as racist, right? As a place where actions are motivated by people with power on the basis of certain ways of understanding white supremacy, certain ways of understanding their place in the world vis-a-vis other, you know, other folks who look different from them, so on and so forth. So can you tell us a little bit about both that representational aspect of Lordian rage? And then I do want to hear more about the account you give of the value of Lordian rage and the way that it lifts people up and expresses or asserts value and these sorts of things.
Yeah, and it's interesting because before I make those latter claims that you just alluded to, I have to motivate the representational point.
Right.
Because that's gonna ground the what we call kind of the fittingness kind of claim. Right?
Sure.
The appropriateness kind of claim. And without even going so deep in philosophy of emotion, I mean, you know, I kind of take the view that emotions represent the world, right? So like the humorous, something that is funny represents the funny, right?
Yeah.
The kind of thing, you know, sadness kind of represents the, you know, the sad. you know, and anger represents the unjust. It represents the awful. Right. You know, and one of the things that I simply claim is that, you know, you can imagine if you were a judge and all these anger types come to you and say, hey, I'm right in what I'm saying. My anger's apt. You know, and Rogue Rage says, no, my anger's apt. I'm right about the world. And then, you know, so how would you make the decision as the judge? And one of the things that I say is that, you know, Lordian rage is more likely to represent the world than these other types. And there are several reasons why. And when I say represent the world, particularly if Lordian rage is responding to racial injustice, which I suggested these anger types kind of arises in a sense of injustice, is that, you know, one of the things that people say is that, hey, I mean, they doubt the fittingness condition of anger, right? They say, oh, either you don't have anything to be angry about or you're exaggerating, et cetera, et cetera. So I found that to be very, very important to motivate before I continue on with the argument in the book. And so I kind of lay out in a lot of detail about, listen, if it's anger in response to racism, I scapegoats. Because even scapegoats within itself tells us something epistemically about that. It's not really hitting at the true target and it's not really assessing the reality of the world, right? And so when I say that Lordian rage is directed at racism, racist attitudes, I got to prove in some way that those things are real things in the world. Right. And so I do spend some time because I knew that I had to even in the times in which we were living, I wrote the book when Trump was still our president and you have these right wing groups and these hate groups arising. I still had to find myself doing work to try to convince the person who still says that racism is a thing in the past. right. That's the kind of mindset that I was working in. And I was simply saying, hey, I mean, and particularly in the U.S. context, the context that I'm focused on in the book, is that, listen, you know, when you see, and mind you, I'm also writing in the context of Black Lives Matter. So, you know, you think about these people who are angry at racism. If it indeed is the case that Lordian rage is representing the world, what is this world? And so, I just begin to explain the kind of racism and neo-racism that has arisen in our particular context. And I spent some time kind of describing that because it's clever. Racism is clever. It also changes over time. And so the racism that, you know, your parents probably saw and witnessed perhaps is not so explicit today. And we are so quick to say that therefore racism does not exist. And so I already spent some time kind of laying that stuff out. And basically I'm doing all that work, which may seem like repetitive and redundant for people who've already believed me, particularly because I want to say, so when people come to you with claims that they are angry at this racist world that we live in, you'll be more apt to believe them, right? And you know, one of the things I'm very careful is I'm not saying, what I'm saying is that, you know, given the reality of the United States and someone has Lordian rage, their Lordian rage is more likely to represent that particular reality. But it's not to say that everyone who is angry and is always angry at racism, believe me, because what I just saw really did happen. The experience that I had at the mall was, I mean, it's not to say that every instance, no one would be lying and no one would be incorrect about what they previously assess. but they're more likely, if they have low earnings, they're more likely given the reality in the world in which we live. And, you know, and that, what that is, that becomes a springboard, right? Because already, you know, one of the things that I saw in the criticism is that, like I said, you know, not only is it a criticism of anger at racial injustice, that what you see in the world or what you're saying happened didn't really happen. It's not really the case. You're being oversensitive. You're bitter, et cetera, et cetera. Is that it was important for me to kind of lay that as the foundation to say that this anger is fitting. And based on that springboard, I can begin or continue to make or build this stronger argument. So I want to say that Loading and Rage is in response to this racism that is real in the world. So it is a fitting response to a reality that is just messed up. So out of that, as a result, let me tell you why it's useful. Let me tell you why it's essential to the struggle to kind of combat that particular reality that it represents. So I simply say, you know, and I can say this in brief, and perhaps if you have more questions about this. So one of the things that I say, even despite the features that I talk about, I want to say that Loading and Rage is essential to anti-racist struggle. Number one, because this fitting anger has a tendency, has a community of power to ascribe value to the marginalized. And that's an important thing to do. I mean, anger has a community function. It protests. It reminds us that wrongdoing has occurred. It holds people accountable. So it's very much communicative, but it is also a way of valuing and a way of showing value. And particularly, you know, I'm writing the context in a book, context of reality in which Black Lives Matter used to be controversial to say.
Right.
And hence the All Lives Matter retorts. And it's still, for some people, that's still controversial to say. And it's still people who still believe. I mean, the wealth gap just goes to show you that not all lives matter. I mean, so one of the things I just wanted to be very, very clear about from the very beginning of the book, that what I find beautiful about Loading and Rage and why I think it's essential is that, you know, oppression just makes you, it doesn't make you feel good about yourself. It's dehumanizing. Racist treatment is dehumanizing. And so one of the things about anger, as much as we think that it's always speaking to the wrongdoer, one of the things that it does say is it says to the marginalized, your life is valuable. And I also say connected to value, not only is their life valuable, but it also reminds us that justice is valuable. And so it awakens us to the fact that justice does not exist in this particular context, but it's valuable, so it needs to exist. So it ascribes values in those particular ways. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's essential. Another reason why I think it's essential to anti-racist struggle is because of its motivational component. Right. I mean, remember, like I said, that these anger types are going to motivate some kind of action. I mean, this is just what anger is. I mean, it has an approach tendency. So while sadness or fear may make you want to run away or retreat, you know, anger just has this component that is going to make you approach the target of your anger, right? And so people have been wondering or been claiming throughout the literature and that, you know, hey, anger is motivational. Anger is motivational. Use your anger. Get motivated. Get fired up. but there hasn't been a lot of accounts of why that is the case. Like what was happening there? And so that kind of led me to really go to the social psychology literature and cognitive science literature and try to figure out what's going on in the brain there. What's going on in the individual when an individual is angry that would lead them to be motivated to do anything? And one of the things that I found is three things in particular, and I suggest and I argue in the book that these are what I call the fuel features of anger, right? It helps us make sense of why it's so motivational. So one fuel feature of Loading and Rage is self-belief. So when angry, you believe, so it's kind of two, let me just say, self-belief, optimism, and risk aversion. So the studies show that when you're angry, you believe that things can change and you can change it. I mean, that's just the reality. I have experienced that in my life when it has nothing to do with injustice. So you believe that things can change and that you can do something about it. You can change it. And you're also willing to engage in certain kind of risks in order to make those things happen. I mean, one of the examples I like to use, there's moments in my life where I may get frustrated, or just angry about, you know, the state of affairs, whether that's career-wise or whether that's whatever. And it's in those moments where I just believe, okay, no one can change my life but me. I know I can make things better. And so what I start to do is start to make moves, take risks that I probably wouldn't take if I wasn't in that particular state, like email people, apply to jobs. I mean, just do stuff that I probably wouldn't do under that particular phenomenon. And that, you know, that in that particular state, I become, you know, it's a motivational state, and those things are particularly happen. And so as a result of those few features, it really made me think about two particular figures. Think about Ida B. Wells, and think about Sojourner Truth. Two black women who were born in slavery, who basically lived their lives, you know, struggling for black folks, struggling for women. And you think about Ida B. Wells, who through her journalism, you know, brought attention to anti-lynching campaign and was able to keep fighting despite her press being burnt down. Think about Sojourner Truth, born in slavery, quote unquote, uneducated woman, but still gave these speeches and really was a black feminist to the highest regard, you know, striving to get rights for black women. And I think about, you know, it's 2022, you know, I'm a black woman. I have a certain kind of boldness with me that I think really is a privilege of my time. You know what I mean? Like, and so when I think, I mean, there's certain things that I can say and do now that really is the benefit of people who've come before me. And it makes me think a lot of times about, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people like to say, well, if I was living in those days, I would've, you know what? I don't know what I would've done. I doubt it if I would've had a press. Now, I think I'm a force, but I ain't that kind of force. Right? I'm not the Ida B. Wells kind of force in her particular context, right? So just trying to understand these women, like as much as we praise them, I really was trying to understand where did their courage come from? And I think both of these figures, you know, they were described as being angry, right?
Right.
And so just trying to make sense of, oh, it's because of their anger that they was able to do these things, right? That they were motivated based on these few features. And that's what kept them going. And so without that anger, without those few features, it makes me wonder, I mean, what would Ida B. Wells' life look like? What would Sojourner Truth look like? And the progress and the gains that they were able to make. And so that's one of the reasons, another reason why I think that anger is essential. It has these few features that motivates you to do a kind of thing in the world. And remember, if Loading Rage has the original features that I talk about that make it different from these productive kinds, then the kind of motivating actions that one are going to engage in is going to be productive. Right. So I do want to acknowledge, hey, you can't storm the Capitol without some kind of risk aversion, self-believing, and some kind of optimism. You know what I mean? But but who you going to try to kill when you're there? I mean, that's going to have a lot to do with the kind of anger that you have. Right. And so, you know, yeah, people should be scared of that white rage that they witness at the Capitol. But only people who don't want to transform their society for the good should be scared of the kind of anger that the Ida B. Wells of 2022 has today. And then I go on, and then the kind of last argument that I give before I offer up anger management techniques, talk about how anger can also, you know, and having the kind of Loading Rage that I talk about allows one to be what I call kind of a resistant figure, that with Loading Rage, one is able to resist certain kind of what I call racialized or racial rules in society. That simply says only white men can be angry because of the value that we ascribe to their lives. And so, I simply say that you don't even have to go to a protest. But just by having anger, you don't have to be a charismatic leader, but just by having Loading and Rage, there's certain ways in your life that you can engage in resistance because of this particular emotion. And so that's why I think it's essential. And that's why I think we should get rid of it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I want to get to the social rules disruption in a minute. You in describing or arguing for the value of the sort of fuel aspects of Lordian rage, you give some attention to critics who might say, well, wait a minute, expressions of rage can be counterproductive because of the effect that expressions of rage, particularly black rage, is going to scare people, right? It's going to turn people off, right? Can you say something a little bit about your engagement with that kind of critique?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, it goes back to Audre Lorde, right? So, like I said, her essay, Uses of Anger. And at the very beginning of the essay, a white woman comes to her after she gives a speech. And this is Audre Lorde kind of recounting it. And she comes back and she gives a speech, and a white woman comes to her. You know, you give these talks and people come talk to you afterwards. And the white woman says the following: "Tell me how you feel, but don't say it so loudly or I cannot hear you." And Audre Lorde's response, you know, basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, is it the tone or is it the angry response that bothers you? Or is it the message that's going to force you to change your life, right? And, you know, that has always stuck with me, right? That, like, you know, we really have to kind of consider, as much as we like to put the responsibility on the angry person and their tone and the way that they're expressing their anger, and that's the reason why we can't really receive it. And that's why the powers that be won't receive it. So calm it down, tone it down, you know, kind of calls for civility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I do, like, kind of changed my thinking on this. And you know, for me, it's like, listen, if you have a problem with someone being angry, you know, expressively, that the fact that another black boy was killed on the street, you have to be a certain kind of person to say that I can only hear you if you change the way you're speaking, right? It simply says, one is not really, I mean, we can make these assumptions, one is really not attuned, one is really not sympathetic, right? Really, one is really doesn't consider that life valuable, right? I mean, I don't know about you, Bob, but there's moments, you know, as being a friend, I mean, one of the roles of a friend is to, you know, to be a listening ear to a whole bunch of experiences and troubles that your friends are having. And there's no doubt that, you know, they have, you know, they're going through stuff and they come to you, and I never tone police my friends. If anything, I'm the one that's going to be pumping them up, be like, what, girl? I'm so, like, I'm the one that's saying you have a right to feel this way, right? Because it would just be totally insensitive. It's like, well, tell me how you feel. I know your grandmother just died, but can you, like, stop sobbing so extremely or I cannot hear you, right? We wouldn't do that in our relationship. So why do we do that when it comes to certain kinds of issues, right? And so one of the things I say, hey, people think that anger is going to run away allies or anger is going to run away the powers that be. No, anger is only going to run away certain kinds of allies. And I basically say, well, if the anger is the problem and not the issue, then you're not yet ready to be an ally. So that's kind of my response to that. And there's a lot of kind of counterproductive kind of critiques that I respond to in brief at the end of that chapter. And those are probably one of the most popular ones that really, really, really bothers me. I think kind of connected to that, we always think that uptake is always required for anger to be productive. So, you know, the powers that be must listen to me. They must listen to, you know, what I have to say. And so, you know, make your anger look a certain kind of way. And I'm just reminded by the work of Maria Lagunas. And, you know, anger is not always for the wrongdoer. Right, that's there's right. one kind of anger that is for that, right? That's that protest piece. But like I said before, if anger also ascribes value and remind marginalized people that you are valuable, my anger is for them and not necessarily for you, right? So kind of decentering the wrongdoer and decentering the powers that be, that just because you don't listen doesn't necessarily mean that it's counterproductive, because it doesn't hang always on your uptake.
Right. And I guess that at least I detected this in some of the responses to these sort of critiques that, you know, expressions of rage, you know, erect obstacles. You know, that the issues about tone and expression and heat, you say, well, the message can't be so easily distinguished from, you know, from the high tech, you know, if I tone it down, I'm not delivering the message anymore, right? The message is not so easily distinguished or separated or detached from the emotional articulation of it. Does that seem right?
No, that seems sounds right. You also sound very Lordian right now. I'm reminded of a passage from the essay, and you know, she says, "This is Audre Lorde here." She says, "I cannot." Basically, I'm trying to get her exact words right. she says, "I would not hide." She was like, "I would not." In some ways, we can say that she says, "I would not tone it down to spare your guilt." And then she says that doing so trivializes our efforts.
Yeah.
Right. That is her words. Exactly. It trivializes our effort. So, you know, I really am so happy to see and to hear that there's a lot of people who are writing about civility and calling attention to kind of the asymmetry that goes on with those particular calls and always the constant movement of what those civil standards are. Because I think that's a topic that truly, really, really, really needs to be addressed.
Oh, absolutely. Great. So can we get back then to the sort of feeling rules, the social rules about feelings and the two commandments that you that you say that Lordian rage disrupts?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to give like a feminist philosophy of emotion 101 because I do borrow heavily from that literature to kind of to kind of apply it to the racial context. So you know, a lot of stuff in the literature, feminist philosophy literature, that's from the 80s and the 90s, have basically kind of described anger, particularly when experienced by women, as what we call kind of outlaw emotions. And the reason why they're called outlaw emotions or kind of to engage in these particular emotions is what some philosophers describe as an act of kind of affective transgression. Is a because there's feeling rules, right? There's particular rules that some people of certain genders are allowed to express and other people are not. So men are allowed to express anger. When they do so, you know, we applaud them. It's considered a virtue. Women are supposed to express compassion, forgiveness. When they do so, they are particularly, you know, rewarded, right? We've learned that, right? There's a wonderful book called Rage Becomes Her that came out a couple of years ago in response to the Me Too movement. And, you know, it's talking about anger in the context of gender injustice. And it talks about how we learn these particular rules as you know, these gender-related emotional rules as children. So we teach our young girls, you know, it's not beautiful to be angry, right? It's not feminine to be angry, right? So, you know, we teach our boys, you know, not to cry. Like, we're already teaching them these particular feeling rules. And people are, rewarded and punished if they express or violate these particular rules. So I want to say, well, there's also racial rules, racial feeling rules. There are some emotions that are fit for certain kind of racialized bodies and that can be rewarded or punished as a result. So white men can be angry. Kavanaugh recently, those senators reminded us that, right? Even white women that we call Karens can be angry on the police phone calls, right? And they, you know, police will come out and be attuned to them no matter how irate they make it. But it still is the case that black people cannot be angry, right? They're supposed to be kind of long-suffering, kind of patient, et cetera, and they will be rewarded, and that is not die as a result, right? So it's these rules that are set up in that particular way. And not only do we evaluate emotions differently, but we also read emotions different on racialized bodies, right? So I basically say, you know, we want to make sense of like a stereotype of the angry black woman. I mean, this is stereotypes as a way to kind of reinforce those particular rules, what I call kind of feeling rules in a racialized context. But I introduce racial rules. So I just don't say that these are just feeling rules in the context of race. I say, hey, these are racial rules. Because it's not just people telling you what feelings to have, but behind these feelings are also kind of values, normative values, status quo values, white supremacist values that kind of go with that, and kind of behavioral kind of commands that's connected to that. So here's an example. So there's two what I call racial rules that I lay out. One racial rule is thou shalt not have a right to white male rage.
Right.
And I do say it in very New James, King James Version language. Thou shalt not have a right to white male anger, right? And so I basically said, well, if that's the rule in our society, which is the rule, right? Women can't have it. White women can't have it up to a certain extent. If a white woman is angry to Black men, for example, we go back to the Kristen Cooper Central Park, and that is allowable. But all things considered, you know, white women can't, but can in a racial context. But Black people, Muslim, you know, that is racialized as Arab, et cetera, cannot have the kind of anger that we allow white men to get away with. And so right. One of the things that I say is that when you decide to still be angry, knowing that this rule exists, because we know that this rule exists, and then you decide that you're going to be angry in spite of it, right? You are breaking that racial rule, right? And there's several ways that I kind of suggest, right? You're basically saying, in doing so, and resisting these particular rules, you're basically saying that white men are not the only people that have a right to value and claims to respect. You're also kind of, when I talk about a resistant figure, you're resisting kind of this kind of policing that says, that I can't fully express my emotions and make certain kind of claims. So I'm resisting that kind of powers that be that wants to shut me up and to silence me. And so that's the kind of way that I kind of set that particular argument up. That given we have these racial rules in society, just having the anger that you break that rule and the racist assumptions and the behavioral kind of assumptions that come along with that.
Fabulous. So there's a whole chapter that is subtitled A Note to Allies. this is a chapter about rage renegades. Can you tell us a little bit about the special note to allies?
So it's interesting because I remember giving a talk when I was still working on the book. I gave a talk to some Pixie students at Penn State. So this is a program that women philosophers have created to diversify the discipline. And so they invite a diverse undergrads to Penn State, also to MIT, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Yes, for the summer and get them exposed to philosophy and philosophy professors, et cetera, et cetera. And so at the time, I'm giving a talk on the last chapter, or what I take will be the last chapter, which is the anger management chapter. I'm giving a talk to students. And I remember a young brother raises his hands and he's like, well, what about white people? Now, mind you, the last chapter of the book talk about just general techniques that I think that we can incorporate to make sure that anger stays motivational, that it stays appropriate, that it stays resistant, right? So I'm not telling people to get rid of it, but these are ways to keep the features that I suggest that makes loading and rage unique. And so, you know, I'm giving a talk, think I'm doing a good job, think I fully have answered all the objections that's gonna make that chapter kind of useful. And he asked me, you know, what about white people? And I'm like, and I remember my response to him, I'm not writing to white people. If they don't get it, they just don't get it, right? And so that was my immediate response. And I was like, well, I leave that up to you. Young man is now, you know, a graduate student in philosophy. I was like, I'm just going to leave that up to someone else's project, which is probably a popular response that we always say when we don't want to do something. We say, oh, that's not my project. But, you know, that stuck with me. It really just stick with me. And I thought, well, before I get to the general kind of anger management notion, is there something, I think there is something that I need to say to white folk who are allies in the struggle. And I'm using allies in quotes because I know that the term itself is controversial, but it's pointing to a particular group. Is it something that I can say? I do think that there are things that they can do with their rage that can be counterproductive to the anti-racist struggle and also reify the very system that they're fighting against. And perhaps what I can attempt to do is to highlight some of those concerns to make sure that they don't repeat it. And that can be kind of I don't want to say an asterisk, but kind of a certain kind of level of anger management that they need to be attuned to before we go to the general stuff. Good. And so simply what I call them rage renegades, and I call them rage renegades because these are, I mean, I use white folks, but you know, from a general standpoint, we can say that rage renegades would be any kind of anger that I have in response to the oppression that has hit one group more intensely than the other. And I'm not a member of that particular group. So I was a rage renegade. I am a rage renegade to the Asian American community who for the last few years have experienced anti-Asian hate and violence. And so kind of use you know, white folks as a descriptor here, but to be a little bit more specific about what makes this phenomenon quite different than in the general context is that, you know, rage renegades are white folks who are angry at injustice, racial injustice, angry that they live in a racist world. And all of this world is kind of built in order to benefit them. They resist that particular system, right, by being angry at it, right? Mm-hmm. But I still say, hey, white supremacy is a hell of a drug. It's a constant fight, not only for white folk, but also for Black folk, for Hispanic folk, for everybody, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's an ideology that can inflict us all. I don't care who you are. And how can right. you make sure that you don't bring those kind of white supremacist kind of beliefs in a way into the anti-racist struggle, particularly when it comes to anger? So people might think, oh, I have loyalty and rage. I'm good. There's no mistakes right. that I can make. Right. Because I got loyalty and rage. Right. My anger is saying all lives matter. My anger is, you know, breaking racial rules. My anger is motivating me to engaging in kind of productive action with other people. I'm good. And I'm saying, no, not necessarily. So there are two particular, I guess, in some ways, there's a variety of ways in which I say that allies can go wrong with their anger. Because that's the claim of the book. I mean, there's a lot of literature right. in the book talk about how allies can go wrong, but I specifically want to address how can it go wrong with anger specifically. So one way that it can happen, and I kind of leave some kind of like something for the book, if you were to get excited about the book, but one of the ways that it could go wrong is when you think that your anger matters more than the anger of the racially oppressed.
Right.
Now, I want to be sympathetic here. We live in a world, and I've already alluded to this, and which, based on your racialized body, your emotions are going to be read differently, and it's going to be given a certain kind of uptake or lack of uptake based on your racialized body. So we know as a white man, he can be angry, and we will respect it. We'll listen to it. We take it as to be a little bit more rational, et cetera, et cetera. We know that's not the case for all other people. And so if you live in a society that has already showed you that that's the way it goes, then I want to say that even when you begin to have anger in response to something worthy like an anti-racist struggle cause, you think you're going to lose that kind of thinking? Or you think right. that's automatically going to disappear? Right. And so, you know, so what happens when you have loyalty and rage and you think, even if it's just for a moment, for a second, or certain kinds of moments, or when the film crew comes, when you think in that moment that your anger matters more, and it'll be hard not to, particularly when your anger is listened to. When the reporter right. puts the mic in your face first, right? And I think an example right. that I use is the Portland example. There was an officer, Christopher J. David, I believe that's his name, and he's getting beat with batons. And he gets all these interviews. And I remember him saying, you know, if I was a Black naval officer, no one would be interviewing me. And he basically says, I think the focus needs to be off of me and go back to the whole purpose of the protest, which is Black Lives Matter. Wonderful ally.
Right.
But there are some mm-hmm. people who would have been like, yeah, I got a lot to say. keep the camera rolling.
That's right.
Let me focus on me, focus on my anger. And you know, I just want to bring attention to that. And there's ways that you can do it in a very extreme way. And there's a way that you can do it in a very subtle way. But I want to suggest doing it, thinking it, or at least communicating that your anger matters more is undermining the very struggle. And then I just kind of offer up suggestions on when you find yourself in that mode. Give space. To right. people of color to speak, for example, move to the back of the line, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So it's a kind of grandstanding, would you say?
Yeah, I guess one can say. I mean, so that's one way, thinking your anger matters more. But there's another instance that I call moral anger grandstanding. That's more for the signaling purposes, right?
Right.
So you want to use your anger. I call it moral anger grandstanding. You know, you want to, yeah, you do all the moral grandstanding stuff, but you do it with anger. And I want to say that that's a kind of different phenomenon. But the suggestions, the prescription, the corrective is quite similar. So those are some things that I think can go awry as rage renegades, and we just need to be conscious of it. Right. Yeah.
Great. So let's, you know, the book ends with anger management, because as you were just saying a moment ago, you know, given everything that you've laid out about the value and importance and the fueling aspect of loyalty and rage, there's still constraints or there's still ways in which it can go off the rails and be misdirected or be co-opted. Can you tell us a little bit about the management task for loyalty and rage?
And it can go wrong because we are human beings.
Right.
Right. And, you know, my kind of strategy, when it comes to loyalty and rage, when it comes to management, is I think about a manager, and you know you've encountered a good manager when that manager, wants to bring out the very best in you. You know, you've probably perhaps some people have encountered managers who just want to get rid of people. Let's just fire people. And I think good management is, no, I want to use the people that I have, and I just want to make sure that I utilize their gifts and bring out the very best in them. And I think when I talk about anger management, I'm not talking about eliminating anger. I'm not talking about bringing anger to a certain kind of temper that can be read as a kind of civil kind of response. I'm really talking about bringing out the very best of loading and rage, right? So how can we make sure that the features that I've talked about in loading and rage, that we are able to maintain these particular features, that it stays appropriate, that it stays motivational, that it stays resistant? And so my strategies are not novel, but the way that I use my strategies to help us maintain these positive features is what I think is novel. So one of the things that I think people are going to be like, duh, but one of the first techniques that I talk about is express anger, right?
Right.
Now, expression is good, and there's a variety of ways to express. So why do we want to express? Well, you know, a lot of people are concerned about maybe kind of worried when I mention expression, because they have, at least in their minds, have made angry expression synonymous with kind of like violent expression. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of say in the chapter is, like, you know, James Baldwin, when he's writing about anger, his only worry when it comes to anger is his criticism of anger, is that he believes that, you know, anger can transform into hatred, but it can transform into hatred when it's unexpressed, right? He's very concerned about unexpressed anger. Right. And one of the things that we know the social psychology literature suggests is that the problem is not violence. People think anger equals violence. No, it's not. It's not that. First of all, there's other emotions that are more apt to, you know, lead one to engage in violence. So I don't know why we think that anger is the most concerning thing. But fear, for example.
right.
But one of the things that is often said is that suppress and repress anger can really lead to some problematic things. And so that's why I think expression is important. If we're really concerned about anger being productive in the ways that we need to make sure that even though you got the virtuous loading and rage kind of anger, you want to make sure that you're constantly expressing it. I also think that not only does it allow it to be productive in that particular sense, that particularly if anger is communicative to a point and we want it to continue to ascribe value to people, that, right, you know, you need to express your anger. And whether that's just, you know, acknowledging it to yourself, acknowledging it to others. I mean, that's a way that it's constantly doing the kind of things that I suggest it does, given its communicative aspect. So expression is important to me in maintaining these positive features. Another kind of technique that I kind of lay out is the importance of getting in solidarity with other folk. Right. So one of the things that we know, you know, listen, I'm not asking people to get with people so we can have a huge rage fest and we can just get angrier, right? But when you're in solidarity with people, I mean, not only if one person is fired up, motivated, then we know that motivation is contagious, right? So that's the kind of productive piece. But another thing that we know is that, listen, if I find that my loading rage is not appropriate, I got somebody to keep me accountable, to hold me accountable to that, right? So there's something about solidarity that can do that work. Another thing that I kind of talk about is the importance of anger management technique is the importance of being very careful of kind of resisting what I call kind of the moral police. What I call a general category is kind of silencers. So like the moral anger police, right? And trying to recognize when people are trying to be very insincerely, but tactically trying to temper your rage and get you to quiet up. Because the more critics, they're going to read this book and still say, hey, I'm still against anger. And I'm still going to tell people, you know, to do all those things that Audre Lorde suggests that we shouldn't do. So how can we make sure that we stay away from those people? How can we make sure that those people do not have an effect? Those kind of critics don't have any effect on making us feel shameful of the anger. And so I kind of offer up strategies. And it's just recognizing when you have encountered kind of the difference between someone who's an anger police and someone who is a moral critic. So trying to know the difference, because not everybody who has something to say about your anger is a moral police, more anger police. And then just remind them of certain things that when you have encountered someone who's trying to police your anger, that you can just remember, as Audre Lorde reminds us, that everything can be used except what is wasteful. And you will need to remember this when you're accused of destruction. I mean, these are her words. And so just, you know, kind of certain kind of strategies for those individuals to say to themselves, so that they won't be psychologically seduced to get rid of something that I think is very, very important. Those are just some of the strategies that I offer up.
Yes. Well, Maisha, I really, really enjoyed the book. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. That means a lot. I'm just trying to be like you, Bob. I'm just trying to be like you.
That means a lot to
me. I'm going to do Overdoing Anger. My next book is Overdoing Anger.
That's fabulous. What is the next book is on forgiveness? Am I right about that?
It is. Sorry if I let anyone down by that title. The next book is on forgiveness, the failures of forgiveness. So I'm still kind of doing, I'm Nietzsche in this respect that I'm going to do a reevaluation of these emotions. And so just like I've done the same thing with anger, I want to allow us to kind of think differently about this thing we call forgiveness. And not just forgivers, but us as individuals that participate in the general practice. So those who criticize forgiveness, those who expect forgiveness, those who like to use it and as propaganda, et cetera, I'm challenging us all to kind of think very differently and to do differently when it comes to forgiveness. So I'm pretty excited. And that's coming out in the fall of 2023.
All right. Well, Princeton
University Press.
Then.
Yeah. Yes. Next year.
Yeah, I look forward to that. I will look forward to reading it. But for now, Maisha, I just want to thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was fun. Always fun to talk to you, Bob.
It's always fun to talk to you. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us, Maisha Cherry and I, for our discussion of Maisha's new book. It is titled The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. It was recently published by Oxford University Press. I highly recommend it. Thank you, everyone, for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.